This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood to explore a pilot program that's helping school marching bands pamper parade feet post-Mardi Gras, celebrate the grand opening of a performing arts center in Central City, or connect with a contemporary dance troupe from New Zealand. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Those high-stepping musicians who make up school marching bands that entertain us along parade routes carry a different tune post-Mardi Gras. Oh, my aching feet. A common cry has caught the attention of the New Orleans Musicians Clinic and Assistance Foundation. A pilot program, Parading Feet, is connecting students, band leaders, and parents with foot care resources to make uncomfortable feet in marching bands a bygone carnival tradition. Joining me now is Erica Dudas with the New Orleans Musicians Assistance Foundation, along with KIPP band director Joshua Spate. Welcome.
Thank you.
How y'all doing? Thank you.
When revelers are watching parades, the music and dance moves of the marching bands make for great conversation. But foot care? Not so much.
Foot pain is not a sexy topic.
Erica, what made you focus on the marching band's feet?
You'll see the marching bands and you'll see the brass bands just running ragged by the end of Mardi Gras. So a few months ago, this volunteer program director, Mark Lindy, he's a podiatrist out of Canada. He's worked for 35 years all over the country, in New Zealand and in Vancouver. He's a musician himself, and he comes down and volunteers whenever he's in town. You know, he took our program, which was initially just a flyer that talked about foot care for diabetics, for marching bands, and he turned it into this program by securing donations from different foot care companies, like Right Sock, Anti-Blister, and Formthotics Insoles.
The program is called Parading Feet. Joshua, as band director for KIPP, Central City Academy's Tiger Marching Band, what has been your experience with the students participating in parades?
My kids actually had a funny chant while we're practicing marching around the school. Ooh, my feet hurt.
That's what I heard, yeah.
And we laughed so much while they were doing that. It takes a lot out of them. You know, we march in parades back to back, you know.
Have you had situations in the past where maybe some kids didn't make it to the end of a parade route?
Most definitely.
What type of mileage are we talking about when we march in all these parades?
These parades, on average, are 6 to 8 miles. Now.
And they're doing more than just marching.
Oh, yeah. You know, you have to march. You have to play your instrument. The drummers never stop. While they're beating on the drums, they're going nonstop. And then also you have all the different support groups like your color guards, your majorettes. The kids, they go nonstop for however long they push through.
I think a lot of people just don't realize how much work goes into this. Right there, you're talking about doing 5 parades at 6 miles. I mean, that's 30 miles right there, and you're not even talking about practice.
How are you coming to the rescue of the school marching bands?
We're just trying to think through issues that are specific to musicians. We're all about occupational care, preventive health care. So if there's something that we can do ahead of time, a product that we can get, or information or education that we can have around an issue that has a potential to take kids out of the parade because their feet hurt, we're going to do what we can to do it. So this year's our first year working with a band. We chose KIPP because they're incredible, and when we put the call out, they were one of the first to respond.
In this pilot program, can you tell me what type of foot problems are being addressed?
Anything from blister to foot pain, ingrown toenails, anything that's going to take a kid out of the parade, we want to address early on. And I should say that it's not just the insoles that they get, or it's not just the right socks, the anti-blister socks. It's also the education around it. So what are some, you know, cheap and easy ways to prevent blisters? You know, what are some ways that you can remediate them so that they don't become a 3-day problem, so that you can, you know, address it immediately and make sure that you're still in the game? I think understanding these kinds of issues that even young musicians face is just so important, and it's so much a part of our mission at the Assistance Foundation, because that kid that we can keep marching in the parade, or that band member that we can keep on his feet all day for Fat Tuesday. Yeah. I mean, that's keeping New Orleans music alive, and that's what we're all about.
Erica Dudas with the New Orleans Musicians Assistance Foundation and KIPP Band Director Joshua Spate. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you. Ow!
My legs are aching so bad.
Plans are in the works to reach out to more school marching bands. For information on the pilot program, Parading Feet, you can log on to neworleansmusicianscclinic.org. The Ashe Cultural Arts Center is expanding its Central City campus with a $7.4 million performing arts center and visual art gallery. A ribbon cutting and grand opening events are planned this weekend for the Ashe Powerhouse. The new facility is the result of a 16-year relationship between Ashe and Gulf Coast Housing Partnership, Inc. Joining me now is Ashe Executive Director Carol B. Bell. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. We really see all of this campus as something that was kind of assembled and operates at the pleasure, of the community. And so we're excited about having yet another place where we can do our stuff together.
Tell us about the partnership between Ashe and Gulf Coast Housing.
Gulf Coast Housing is a community development corporation. The leader of that organization is Kathy Laborde, and Kathy and I met at a breakfast one morning when she asked to meet with myself and Douglas Redd to talk about a building that she was developing on Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard, and it was the Venus Gardens building where we currently are. And that was the beginning of us being on O.C. Haley Boulevard. That was December 15th of 1998. Over the 16-year period, we've worked with Kathy in terms of what we did for Ashe, but also in terms of the Boulevard. She's been a main part of Aretha Castle Haley Merchants and Business Association. She developed the Muses. She was the developer for the Nora's Building. She has been a major developer on the Boulevard.
And now 16 years later.
And 16 years later, she just finished developing now the Powerhouse, and we're going to be the tenants there. The work that we've done in Central City has been a we thing. It's been us kind of agreeing on a vision for a community that had vitality to it and also had a deep commitment to social justice and equity, a table that everybody could have a seat at, and a way in which the three C's came together. So community, culture, and commerce came together to create a viable community. And what we loved was the fact that culture was in the mix. And that brings us back to this building. This is an opportunity that is perfect for us in that it allows us to be a participant in some of these many community events that happen in New Orleans. Essence, Jazz Fest, all of the various and sundry festivals that happen. So we're really excited about it, and we are looking to have the community come and bear witness to what can happen when dreams come true.
Now, this project involved an historic rehabilitation and adaptive reuse of a streetcar switching station. How did that come about, and tell us about where it's housed?
It's housed at 1731 Barone Street, and, you know, I have to tip my hat to Kathy. This was a property that she had acquired a long time ago and was trying to figure out how it would feature in the Renaissance that was happening on the Boulevard. You know, I'm not sure that this is a kind of dream that could have come true without this culture of collaboration that exists in Central City. You know, there's a saying that says, if you want something to happen quick, do it by yourself. If you want something to happen that can last, do it with others. And I think she followed that formula.
Now, we're talking about a facility that's over 10,000 square feet.
Yep. We really have dressing rooms now, a state-of-the-art performance space. We have an established gallery, which makes it possible for us to be able to attract sponsors and funders for visual artwork. It gives us some amenities that we're not able to offer in our current location. We are building a renovation budget for our current location. And so the other thing that the Powerhouse does is it makes us more comfortable about being able to enter into a renovation phase for the current space, because we have a place to be able to be working while we're getting the other place brought up to speed.
So what is your vision for the Ashe Powerhouse?
Concerts, theater, conferences. Right now we have our first contract that we've signed is with Southern Rep, and Southern Rep will be doing its season at the Powerhouse. We're really open to trying out lots of different things as we move along. We're talking with some of the filmmakers. They're looking at using parts of the campus for their staging.
Now, in addition to Southern Rep's 2015 season, you also have a visual art exhibit that's coming
up? We have a visual art exhibit. I just talked with Leslie Hammond King on yesterday, and we're going to open an exhibit that's called Ashe Tu Amen. It really is about the presence of symbology and commitment to spirituality that exists for people of African descent. The first exhibit we're going to do is an exhibit on Jeffrey Cook, who was our last artistic director, and we lost him in 2009. So Ron Bechet and myself, Ron, who's over at the Xavier University's Community Art Program, are talking with other visual art friends of Jeffrey and collectors. And we're going to do a bit of a retrospective of Jeffrey. And Jeffrey lived in Central City all of his life. And we feel like it's a really appropriate way to open up the visual art area in the powerhouse. So we'll be doing that probably late March. And then in mid-June, we'll be opening Ashe Tu Amen.
So what's on tap now? How will you celebrate this major milestone?
On Friday, February the 27th at 8 o'clock, we're having what we call the Grand Evening, featuring the Uptown Jazz Orchestra, Dale Baxter, and Jupiter Funk, with appearances by Troy Bechet, Sharon Martin, and Hannibal Lacombe. And then on Saturday, we're going to have the blessing of the powerhouse. That will be directed by our board president, Reverend Dwight Webster. And then during the day, at various points after that, we will have both our children and the women's program, then the men's program, and then finally our in-house artists are going to do showcases. In the evening, we're getting ready for what's being called Uptown Saturday Night. We're going to have Tank and the Bangas and DJ Charles, and we are hoping to have a great, great, great time and an opportunity to really celebrate something fabulous that's happened to all of us, for all of us, and is available to all of us. We really are looking to make a very rich DNA, a cultural DNA, that makes it possible for individuals and community to essentially make itself better by learning. You learn new things, you are able to connect with people, you're able to work together on projects, and in so doing, you begin to think of new things and other things you want to do and to make differently. So it's a big aspiration, and so we shoot for the moon and settle for the stars.
Carol B. Bell, Executive Director of the Ashe Cultural Arts Center, thanks.
I'm so happy to always be here with you, Diane.
The Ashe Powerhouse celebrates cultural connections with live performances at its grand opening events Friday and Saturday at 1731 Barone Street. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Black Grace, New Zealand's premier contemporary dance group, is making its New Orleans debut this weekend. The critically acclaimed troupe will perform highly physical, innovative dance works, accenting the traditions of the South Pacific. Joining me now is Black Grace Artistic Director Neil Iramia. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
I believe congratulations are in order. You are celebrating your 20th anniversary as founder and artistic director of Black Grace.
That's right. I founded the company in 1995, and we're based in Auckland, New Zealand. Aside from us, there's the Royal New Zealand Ballet Company that employs dancers full-time, and Black Grace is the only other company that does that. So it's quite an achievement. We look forward to a great year this year.
What was your vision for this dance company, and how close have you come now, 20 years later?
When I started Black Grace, I wanted to have a company that told stories from the neighborhoods, from the communities that I grew up in, from the Pacific Islands. You see, my parents came to New Zealand in the 1960s, but I was born and raised in New Zealand. So there's a sort of cultural duplicity, I suppose, about me. And I wanted to celebrate some of that. As a dancer, I worked for lots of choreographers who were doing and telling stories from other parts of the community, but none of them were telling stories from my community. And it was quite odd for a male to be a dancer when I started in New Zealand. There were only a handful of male dancers, and then I think there were two Pacific Island male dancers. So I was a minority from the outset. And I remember telling my parents that I was going to go to dance school. I was 19 years old. I was working in a bank, having a gap year before going to university, or as you call it, college. And I told my parents, I said to them, look, I'm going to leave my job at the bank and I'm going to be a dancer. And my mum cried and my father just went. And that was it. He didn't talk to me until I got on an aeroplane 2 weeks later to go to dance school. And so I suppose nearly 30 years later, here I am, sitting in New Orleans.
Who are the dancers that make up the troupe?
The majority of them are from New Zealand and are of Pacific Island or Māori heritage. We have two, I suppose, stray Americans in there, one from Atlanta, Georgia, and another one from Boston. I think I've got that right. They're fantastic. And I think with Black Grace, and I get asked this question a lot by people, people think that the name Black Grace means that we're all brown or of dark colored skin, but that's not the case at all. The name for Black Grace came about because when I was growing up, we used the word black as a way of describing someone who was brave and who was daring.
In the beginning, this was an all-male troupe. Is that still the case today?
No, there are women in Black Grace. I think creatively, I felt like I needed to grow more. People thought, this is this exotic company of buff-looking guys who go out there and slap their bodies and do this work and smile a lot, being Pacific Islanders. And I didn't particularly like that stereotype for us. I wanted people to judge the work before they judged the look of the company as such. So over the years, that changed. At one point, I think in 2007, I had a company of 12 women. On this particular tour, we have 7 men and 2 women performing and 1 cultural dancer who's beautiful. It's quite a troupe.
So let's talk about the program. I hear it will be quite physical. Describe the works individually. What will you perform?
So in the first part of the program, there are 4 short pieces, all very eclectic and quite different from each other. The first piece utilizes traditional Samoan fa'a taupati, which means slap dancing. The dancers slap their bodies to create rhythm. And it's inspired by a song that my mum used to sing to me when I was a young boy, and also some memories of my childhood growing up. The next piece is called pati, and pati is the Samoan word for clap. And this is more of a ritualistic type work and draws on some of the motifs from older works, as well as some of the rhythm patterns from the Pacific Island culture. And it uses a seated dance known as a sa-sa. It's very mesmeric, and it's quite a difficult piece to do. The next one is Mother Mother, and I love my mum. She's amazing. So I made this piece of dance, and it's very physical. There's lots of interesting movement vocabulary. We're doing something that's original. And the last piece in that half is a piece commissioned by the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra in 1999. And it's set to Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 in G by Johann Sebastian Bach. It is inspired by backyard memories of rugby games and wrestling with my brother and friends. And it's very odd to see this kind of movement performed to classical music. And then in the final half of the program is the full-length work. It's called Gathering Clouds. And to give you a little bit of context, in 2008, an economist by the name of Dr. Greg Clydesdale wrote an academic paper in which he made claims about what he called the negative impact of Pacific Island migration on the New Zealand economy. And he made very negative claims about people like me.
What was the claim?
Claim that Pacific Island people coming to New Zealand are lazy. They draw on the social welfare system. They're not particularly clever. And I'm paraphrasing here. They're more likely to engage in sort of sexual activity at a younger age and therefore more likely to have children that they therefore can't go on and look after. They're overrepresented in prison statistics. And we don't have university qualifications at the same level as other similar groups. So just the good old normal kicking that you get from time to time.
And how did you push back?
The Human Rights Commission commissioned a report on it. The Ministry of Pacific Island Affairs, which is a government agency, also commissioned a report. Various universities commissioned reports also. It was found to be poorly researched and poorly written, and a lot of the claims that he made were just plain old wrong. So rather than get all angry and sort of righteous and militant on it, I decided that I wanted to show Pacific Islanders in a particular way. It's divided into three sections. The first section of the dance describes a more traditional people preparing to journey to a new land. So there are some ritual in there, the leaving ceremonies, the idea of courage, the importance of spirituality and religion. That's set to traditional music, so there's drumming, there's choral singing from the Pacific Islands. The second section is the arrival into New Zealand, and it sort of looks at New Zealand circa 1965, 1970s, during an infamous period called the Dawn Raids, where the police and the immigration department would raid homes that they thought they were Pacific Islanders in, who were overstaying their visas or their permits, and drag them off into the night or into the early morning. And the third section is set to a number of the Goldberg variations, again by Bach. It's very, very physical, it's very fast, and it's very athletic. And I hope it's beautifuler in the end. People always say the stories are universal. They translate. I hope to leave New Orleans with a real sense of the Pacific and some happiness, I think, and hopefully a different impression of New Zealand, you know, one different to the hobbits and rugby players and sheep.
Black Grace Artistic Director Neil Irimia, thanks.
Thank you.
The New Orleans Ballet Association presents New Zealand's premier contemporary dance company, Black Grace, making its New Orleans debut at Mahalia Jackson Theatre, Saturday at 8 p.m. More info online at nobadance.com. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at wwno.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.